It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the importance of skepticism.
First, though, a report out yesterday from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism describes the lack of treatment and medication provided for inmates, ex-inmates, after being released from prison.
With a large number of inmates dealing with mental illness, the difficulty finding proper care can land some of them back in jail or prison. Here with us to talk about the report is Nora Hurdle. She's a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Nora, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how common is mental illness among these inmates that we're talking about?
Some of the most recent statistics, well, this in my story, I have a statistic in there stating that about a quarter of the prisoners in the Wisconsin system are taking psychiatric medication.
So what happens when they're released? They're getting this medication, I gather, while they're incarcerated. What happens when they leave?
It depends on whether they're leaving a county jail or the state prison. When you leave the state prison, you get 2 weeks of your psychiatric medication and then a month prescription that you can fill in the community. If you're leaving jail, a lot of times you get a lot less than that. Some jails give as little as 3 days of medication.
So is it after that period just a simple thing to go out and get those prescriptions renewed, or is that when that prescription runs out, that's when we start to see issues?
It's not really a simple thing to get renewed. When someone is in prison or jail, a lot of times if they were on Medicaid, they would get kicked off that while they're incarcerated. And then when they're released, they have to get signed back up with insurance. A lot of times they leave without or they're in prison and they leave and they don't have a doctor in the community. If they don't have a family member to help them get connected with county health services or get back connected with their doctor, that makes it really hard for them to keep on track of their medical needs.
And they've got a lot of competing needs to deal with often. I think you put out in your piece, housing and food might be the first things on their radar, and trying to track down a source to renew that prescription might not be up there.
Right. Some of the advocates that I talk to really think it's important to address all of the life areas that someone has, you know, your community, your shelter, your job, and a lot of times mental health care is just not a top priority.
So those 6 weeks run out, I guess, 2 weeks of prescription, 4 weeks of medication, of prescription then at best, then what? They're out of their medicine.
Right. A lot of these, this population ends up going to the county for health care. The counties have an obligation when people have a certain medical needs, they have to meet them. But a lot of the counties in the state have wait lists. Some of them extend several months. Some of them extend several weeks.
And so I guess the big question here is, going untreated, not getting these medications, is that leading people ultimately back into prison?
In some cases, I think definitely that's the case. You know, a lot of people who end up in the prison system, before that they didn't know that they had a mental illness. So they go in and they get diagnosed and they start getting treatment there. But, you know, they had a mental disorder before they got in, and maybe they were treating it with alcohol or street drugs. And when they get back out again, they don't have the network to get proper health care, so they might go back to drinking and using drugs and other criminal activities to balance what is imbalanced in their own bodies.
And that's one of the more alarming things I saw in your piece, that for some of the people we're talking about, street drugs, illegal street drugs, are more accessible and more affordable than the prescriptions that they had when they came out of prison.
Yeah, mental health drugs, pharmaceuticals are, it's a big business. Those are expensive medications in a lot of cases. And a few of the people that I talked to for this story who have been in this situation, who were incarcerated or are incarcerated and have mental health problems, they have a hard time paying for their medications.
And you did talk to a couple people in this situation, as you mentioned. What kind of stories did you hear from them?
I talked to one man who is currently incarcerated. He is in prison now. I talked to him when he was in jail. He He has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He's 51. He's got agoraphobia and depression. He was being treated in the community, and he lost his Medicaid coverage and started drinking again, and that led him down this road of crime, and that's how he ended up back in prison. And he's afraid that when he gets out, he's not going to have the community health care that he needs to stay out of trouble.
So are there, outside of the state, are there groups around Wisconsin trying to help this transition, help ease the transition from getting medication in prison to finding it in the outside world?
Yeah, there's a lot of advocacy groups. I talked with a few of them. There's the Demeter Foundation in Madison that helps female offenders. There's this group called Infallible Helping Hands in Milwaukee that does the same thing for female offenders. Madison Area Urban Ministry. There's groups in the Fox Valley. There are also state and federal efforts to address this problem. There's an annual $10 million allocation to reduce recidivism, and some of that money goes towards inmates that have mental illness and easing that transition. So Greenlight County, for example, has a grant from that fund, the Becky Young Fund, and they there's a lot of communication between the county jail and the county health and human services, and they're trying to get people having a seamless of a transition between the jail and the community.
I don't know if you looked into this, but is Wisconsin alone here, or are other states contending with some of the same issues?
I talked to the mental health director of the DOC, and he said that this is an issue that every state has. You know, how much medication do you give someone when they're about to release? And you know, you really have to rely on the counties to pick up the slack once they're out of the system.
Is there any movement at the state level to try to tackle some of these problems, make psychiatric help, make prescribers more available to inmates, ex-inmates?
The Robin Voss, the Speaker of the House, he had a task force to address some mental health issues across the state, and they have recommended that state grants be given to encourage psychiatrists to move to underserved areas of the state. And that is something that might help this particular population. So it's on the radar. There was a report in 2009 that said there needed to be more mental health programs to reduce recidivism, because when someone has a mental health issue and they're not being treated, they just, it's a revolving door in and out of the prison or jail system.
Anything else that you heard from the state apart from, you know, from the Department of Corrections head, apart from that other states are dealing with this issue?
Well, I mean, I heard the same thing from the Department of Health or from our DHS that, you know, a lot of it falls on the counties, and the state is doing what they can. But I heard from the counties that budgets are tight and demand is high. So even though the state and, you know, some federal dollars are going into this, there's a lot of demand.
All right, Nora, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Nora Hertl, reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her article out yesterday is called Mentally Ill Ex-Inmates Lack Treatment and Meds.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then our next guest instructs us to think and use skepticism to make our lives better. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett.
Our next guest is on a mission to get you to become more skeptical about the world around you. From dubious commercial claims to hoax stories and everything in between, he says questioning everything is in our best interest.
And he brands skepticism as a constructive and optimistic attitude, a way of life that anyone can and should, he says, embrace.
Joining us now is Guy Harrison. He's a journalist and the author of Think, Why You Should Question Everything. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you say that skepticism could change humankind for the better overnight. How so?
Absolutely. Believe it or not, the great crisis of our world is weak skepticism, and nobody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. Parents don't teach their kids to be good skeptics. Most teachers don't teach it. Politicians never talk about it. But the truth is, we've got this huge daily disaster of weak skepticism. What I mean by that is that people tend to accept before they analyze. They believe before they think. In short, they don't think like good scientists. And that's bad for the individual, It sets them up to be a victim of scam, con artists, all these kind of things, and also to waste time, money, energy on things that probably just aren't true. And in the bigger picture, it slows all human progress. So we all have a stake in this.
Well, and you do make the case in your book that what we should do is learn to think like a scientist every day, and in short, learn to be skeptical every day, to have that part of our thinking honed. It does sound like it could take some work, being kind of on guard with our skepticism every day. What do we get out of it?
Yeah, well, you get a lot out of it. You get a safer existence, for one thing. But you also, I think, if you embrace reality and if you commit yourself to questioning everything, because you just kind of adopt, if you adopt a worldview that says, you know, I'm going to take reality as it is, and if you have a personal attitude that says, I'm not going down without a fight, when something comes up to me, some claim or belief, I'm going to make it earn its keep inside my head before I let it in. And I think when you do that, you set yourself up to have a better life. You have more time to get to the good stuff in life, the real stuff, like friends, family, love, creative work, that kind of stuff.
So that paints a pretty rosy picture of skepticism. So does that mean, you know, if you're the resident skeptic, you're at a party and someone's telling you a great story about being abducted by aliens, I mean, are you going to be the buzzkill who says, I don't think so? I mean, is it possible to be a joyful skeptic?
Absolutely. I hope I am one. And one, I cover that actually in the book. And I say, you know, a skeptic, many people perceive skeptics as just what you said, these buzzkills, these people who just want to rain on everybody's parade and take something away from them. But not at all. Skepticism, if done correctly, is constructive and optimistic. And if somebody at a party says, you know, they bring up the Roswell UFO crash or something like that, I say, wow, you know, that is a great story. I love that story. I know all about it. But did you know this story? And then I'll tell them about the real secret government conspiracy and cover-up that went on at Roswell about these spy balloons that were trying to listen to the Soviet Union testing nuclear bombs and how that was covered up and the government lied. You know, there is a cool story there, but it doesn't really involve aliens. And that's true of almost everything you come across. Somebody tells me a ghost story. Well, I can tell them some great stories about how the human brain actually works and how we all see how we actually see how human vision works and how easy it is for us to be misled by everyday images around us and how it has nothing to do with being crazy or being silly or, you know, your education or anything like that. It's simply part of being human. And people tend to find that interesting. And when you approach people who believe stuff that's probably not true, if you do it as a friend, somebody who's offering a handout to help rather than somebody trying to just win a debate or feel superior, people tend to appreciate it.
Well, and one thing that tends to persuade us is money, is not being skeptical. Someone who goes through life believing a lot of things, maybe putting down money for things, does it come with a pretty big price tag at the end of the day, do you think?
Oh, huge, huge price tag. I've seen it. Big scale, small scale. I've been in stadiums, football stadiums, filled with people, thousands of people who were mesmerized by a faith healer up on the stage who was going through his whole routine. And then his little army of, you know, minions or whatever fanned out with these buckets, not plates, but buckets, huge buckets, garbage cans, really, like big plastic garbage cans. And the people, most of them probably lower income people, filled these containers with cash. And then they had other people running around with credit card scanners for those who had credit cards. And I've seen it firsthand how people who are not aware of how our brains so easily deceive us and how we can be manipulated by people who portray things in certain light. If you're not a good skeptic, you can so easily be a sucker. And that bothers me. I don't like to see that. And then in the big picture, you know, look, here we are in economically challenging times, right? But the world is still squandering trillions of dollars on things like astrology, which really have no basis in science or reality. Medical quackery just drains billions of dollars every year, just in America. Worldwide, it's even more of a problem. So, yes, there's a huge price tag that comes with weak skepticism.
Okay, so let's say that this sounds pretty good. We want to bring more skepticism into our thinking life. How hard is it? What are some steps we can take?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not as hard as you might think. You don't have to put on a lab coat. You don't have to wear safety goggles. You don't have to memorize the periodic table of elements. It's not that hard to think like a scientist in everyday life. What you have to remember is that first of all, you don't have to always take option A or option B. Most people have this misconception in their mind. They think that if somebody comes and says, hey, there's a ghost over there, you have to either say, yes, that is a ghost, or no, I absolutely know that is not a ghost. Well, no, that's not how scientists work. A lot of times, not knowing is the right answer. Saying, I don't know, I'm ignorant of this situation, I can't give you an answer right now, that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Good scientists admit their ignorance all the time. They have to if they're good scientists. So don't ever feel pressured to decide one way or the other when somebody comes at you with an extraordinary claim. But a couple of quick tips is always ask for evidence. Always ask somebody, how do you know this? Simply ask questions. If you ask 5 or 6 good questions, a lot of times these claims just wither and die right in front of your eyes. It's amazing to watch it happen. Just ask questions. And most important, always remember to think before you believe. Think. Do a little bit of work before you come to the conclusion. That's all you have to do. Unfortunately, most people in the world believe before they think.
Do you think you're working against human nature at all with this? Is it in human nature to be kind of a sucker, to want to believe things, to get carried away by stories and things that seem fantastical? Or would you make the argument that we are actually rational creatures, we just have to figure out how to live that more fully?
That's a great question. Yeah, I cover that in depth in the book. The answer is yes and yes. We are both. We are suckers for great stories. We're storytelling machines. Our brains cannot resist a great story, and that's a huge problem with irrational belief. But more importantly, our brains do a great job at navigating through daily life. They do really well for us. They keep us alive. If they hadn't done a good job, we wouldn't be here today. But the way they go about doing the job is not the way that we instinctively imagine that they would go about it. The way we remember things, the way we hear, the way we see, the way we analyze things and come to conclusions about things. We think we're so rational and we're so sensible about it, when actually our brain is playing all sorts of tricks on us, and you need to be aware of that. That's just part of being human, but you got to be aware of it. You got to understand. You got to know. I've got to be a good skeptic. I got to think scientifically. Otherwise, I'm going to constantly make mistakes. Now, as far as are we naturally irrational believing creatures, yes, we are, but we're also naturally rational scientists. That's part of us, too. I used to be a science teacher, and I saw little kids instinctively explore, question, analyze, doubt. I've seen all that. It's in us, too. We've got both. It's just a matter of, you know, and they all have their place, but you've got to ask yourself, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to go really heavily on this emotional side? Not emotional, I don't want to give emotions a bad name, but do I want to go heavily on this side that just goes with gut feelings and hunches and trusts and the last thing I heard? Or do I want to be a really good thinker, one who is careful about what I make, what conclusions I draw?
Now, you also talk a lot about taking care of our brains. Now, this is our skeptical organ that we have to have in good fighting shape. So then, other than eating well and doing crossword puzzles or Sudoku, what can we do to make sure that our brains stay sharp?
Yeah, it's really important. You know, I've got a whole chapter on that you've got to take care of your brain. And we don't think about it enough because our brains are hidden away inside our skulls, so we don't really see it. But you know, I give an example. People will say, oh, I better not eat any more ice cream. You know, it goes straight to my butt or straight to my thighs or something like that. But you never hear anybody say, whoa, I better ease off on the ice cream here because it just goes straight to my brain and makes me grow a sloppy thinker. But that's the reality. A poor diet, eating bad food, makes you a bad thinker. And people need to learn this. And it's very simple. You don't have to have magic potions or take miracle drugs or anything like that. It's, you know, good basic nutrition, leafy green vegetables, blueberries, stuff like that, lots of water, lots of sleep. You need to rest. And a big thing that's very important is physical activity. Our brains evolved to be perched atop a mobile platform, not a platform that lies on a couch, sits in a chair all day, sits in a car to and from, and never gets up and moves. You know, for 99.9% of human existence, we have been standing and walking most of the day. We average human walk 12 miles a day, okay? This all changed like a century ago, okay? It's pretty recent that this changed. And that's the problem is Our brain needs that circulation, that blood flow. It needs that to operate properly. And there's all kinds of good science that I cite in the book that shows this and hopefully will inspire people to get going.
Now, all right. Well, that's a lot of good advice to go right there. Guy, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate all the ideas.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Guy Harrison. He's the author of Think, Why You Should Question Everything.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about a new study that suggests first children are smarter. And we'll find out some of the theories that try to explain that.
And we'll get the scoop on the evolution and secret life of punctuation marks and typographical symbols, including the asterisk and the pilcrow.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about some cool stuff you can see in the night sky during the month of November. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Shorter days and longer nights are an invitation to stargaze. In today's installment of Wisconsin Life, commentator Jim Lattis tells us what's overhead right now.
There's certain things you look for in the autumn sky. One of them is the Big Dipper. It's moving down towards the horizon, moving back towards the northern point on the horizon. The Big Dipper, of course, is Ursa Major, the Great Bear. And so for a long time, that's been associated with the bear thinking about hibernating as it descends into the north. So it's seen as the harbinger of winter, as the bear moving towards hibernation from time immemorial, we'll say. Over in the northeast, another harbinger of winter is there is a bright star called Capella, the first of the group of really bright winter stars that we're going to see more and more of as the year progresses. It's very bright, twinkling low on the horizon, changing colors. And a little bit over into the west is a group of constellations that we usually associate with the fall, the constellations of the Perseus-Andromeda myth. Of course, in the myth, Andromeda is the maiden who's being sacrificed to the sea monster, and then the hero Perseus comes along and rescues her, and her mother Cassiopeia, which is sort of a W-shaped constellation, is up there as well. There's another constellation that's not too close called Cetus, which is usually described as the whale, but mythologically is associated with the sea monster who's coming to get Andromeda. All those constellations are prominent in the eastern sky in early autumn and high overhead by later autumn. You can use those to find your way around the whole sky. If you can find the constellations in that group, then you start filling in the little gaps in between, and you've got a huge part of the sky covered, so they're a great way to approach the constellations. There's also interesting objects. Everybody's seen pictures of the Andromeda Galaxy. It's the closest big spiral galaxy to our own big spiral galaxy. The cool thing is that you can see it with the unaided eye. You don't need the Hubble Space Telescope or something. And you can find it in the constellation Andromeda as sort of a dim, glowing patch in the sky, and quite easy to spot in binoculars. You're seeing light that's taken 2 million years or more to cross the intergalactic space and reach us. It's been described as looking like a candle flame dimmed by wax paper or something along that, kind of a diffuse, dim glow. By later in the winter, it'll be far over into the west as evening progresses, and we'll lose it at some point. But there's plenty of time to catch the Andromeda Galaxy.
Jim
Lattis is an astronomer and the director of the UW Space Place in Madison.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org.
Here to give us more insight into the autumn sky is Bob Bonnader, director of the Daniel M. Sorf Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica.
Well, we just heard about Andromeda there at the end. What does that look like up in the sky right now?
Well, to see it, you need to be in really dark skies far from the city lights, but it looks just like a little fuzzy patch in the sky. But to comprehend that, that is 200 billion stars grouped together in this galaxy, 2 million light years away, is just it blows the mind. So, and it's kind of cool through binoculars if people get a chance.
200 billion stars?
Yep.
Yeah, that's just kind of hard for the brain to take in. How long?
If you counted each star 1 per second, it would take 6,000 years.
Wow. Well, what tips do you have for amateur stargazers? What are some of the best spots to be looking at right now?
Well, we've got the two brightest planets in the sky. So early evening around supper time, if you go out and look southwest, you're going to see Venus just amazingly bright, just brilliant. It's the number one reported UFO in the sky. And then if you're up a little later, you're going to see the planet Jupiter rising about 8 o'clock or so over in the eastern sky. And Jupiter's bright enough to outshine any star in the night sky. So we have our two brightest planets putting on a pretty good show.
Now, in terms of stuff that I guess is coming up, there's a comet that's going to be making its way across the sky, right?
Comet Ison, yes. It's going to get brighter and brighter, should be coming into naked eye visibility. But people are still going to have to get up early to spot it. It's going to be a little tough, and I don't know. It could really brighten, though. Comets are always strange. They're unpredictable. They're sort of like cats. They have tails, and we don't know what they're going to do. So we'll see. We shall see, hopefully.
How will this compare to something like Halley's Comet?
Well, if folks remember back with Halley's Comet back in, what was it, 85, 86, it wasn't placed very well in its orbit this time. So it wasn't all that spectacular. But if folks go back about 16 years ago for Comet Hale-Bopp, that was fantastic. You could see that right from downtown Milwaukee. Maybe this comet will have somewhat of a spectacular show like that. We'll see.
So will you be up at 4 in the morning looking for it?
Well, actually, you have to get up right before sunrise. So about 30, 45 minutes before sunrise is the best time to spot it.
And so did you tell what date or when we can expect to see it?
Well, if more towards Thanksgiving. If you get up maybe the week before Thanksgiving, you should see it near the bright star Spica in the eastern sky. Otherwise, after Thanksgiving, probably last day in November, early December, it should be good right before sunrise, too.
Okay, so Comet Ison heading our way.
Yes.
Another thing coming up is we're launching another mission to Mars. This one is called MAVEN. What do you know about this mission?
Well, this mission really wants to study the upper atmosphere of Mars and why it basically lost its water. Mars, we know, had a lot of water, and where there's water, there's a good chance for life. But Mars' atmosphere got really thin rather quickly, and this mission is going to explore the upper atmosphere and find out why it's losing it and how it lost it.
Is part of the context there, hey, this planet used to have water and could have supported life. Sounds a lot like Earth. Maybe we should find out what happened.
Exactly. And to think that we could be Martians, because maybe life started on Mars and got hit by a meteorite and blew off, and that started the seed of life here on Earth. That's kind of a far-fetched theory, but but it's been out there. So we don't know, but you know, that's a big, huge question. So that's part of the reason we keep going to Mars.
So we could be Martians. That's worth finding out.
We could be. who knows for sure? That theory has been put out there. Hopefully we'll know someday.
What else coming up that we should be looking forward to? Or if we head out our back door tonight that we could see?
Well, a great constellation is Orion. Many people recognize Orion the Hunter, the traditional belt, those three stars right in a row. Now, he's coming up a little late now, 8, 9, 10 o'clock. You have to be up to really see him. But by the end of the month here, early December, you're going to see him up there about 7 o'clock. So he's a sign of winter, I hate to say it, in the night sky. But he's very bright, and look forward to him.
What is your favorite time of year to stargaze?
Oh, I love the winter. I love the winter. It's the brightest sky. It is cold. But if you just get out there for a while, especially away from the city lights if you can, it's going to be well worth your while.
All right. Well, once we lose some of these clouds, I think I'm inspired to do some stargazing. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem, Veronica.
We've been talking to Bob Bonnader, director of the Daniel M. Sorf Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a guest who says there are some serious challenges facing Wikipedia, one of the most popular non-commercial websites in the world. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the unique challenges that face women in the military.
First, it's the sixth most widely used website in the world. And if you need to look up some quick info online, chances are it might be your first stop. For better or worse, Wikipedia has changed the way we seek out information about the world around us.
And while Wikipedia has always faced questions about the quality of its information, our next guest says the site is facing a slew of new issues, including a massive drop in user participation. As a result, quality may be being sacrificed.
Joining us now is Tom Simonite. He's the computing editor for MIT Technology Review. We've got a link to his piece, The Decline of Wikipedia, on our Facebook page. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
So how big a deal is Wikipedia in the online world?
Well, I think the figure you just gave there about it being the sixth most accessed site in the world gives a sense of how much people feel they need it. I know that I use it every day, and I think a lot of people are in that same situation. The number of people that use Wikipedia has grown steadily over the years since the project began, and so it seems like we really do need this information resource.
And when we compare it to a lot of the other top websites in the world, it's really unique. It's not a company sending this out there with a long-term vision of getting investors and making a profit. It's a community effort of sorts.
That's right. It's run by a nonprofit. A nonprofit pays the bills and keeps the site online, but Wikipedia is really created by its community. They're the people that have written every word on there and edit it and put it into shape. And, they don't advertise. People go there because they want information.
And from the outset, it seems there was a tension. There was the idea that, yes, anybody can contribute to this site, but there was the problem that anybody could contribute to this site. It was a strength and a weakness. Can you talk about how that played out over the years?
Yeah, sure. It is still the case that anyone can contribute, but your contribution may not stick around for long. Really, around 2005 was when Wikipedia first started to enter the public consciousness, and there was a lot of media attention at that time, and usage really skyrocketed. At the same time, the number of people contributing went up, and not all of those people were that helpful. You know, they were doing vandalism or hoaxing people by creating fake articles. So around that time, some very sophisticated bureaucracy developed amongst the community where people assigned themselves roles. You know, they would patrol certain pages. They developed ways that they could very quickly scan new contributions and then reverse those that were unwanted. And that's really what made Wikipedia a success. They built the community in this decentralized way, built all these control mechanisms that enable them to, on the one hand, allow anyone to contribute, but on the other hand, still maintain quality and structure. And that's what made it a success. But there were some problems that came along with that as well.
Well, and talk about some of the problems with that. As that bureaucracy developed, was the barrier to entry for somebody who wanted to give it a try, was it too difficult to get in there and make a difference?
It seems that may be the case. It certainly got more difficult because there were a lot more rules to learn, for example. What a good way to look at this is to look at the numbers of people that contribute. So on the one hand, usage of Wikipedia, the number of people going there to find their information, has been going up and up and up over the years. But the number of people that actually contribute to the site has been going down since about 2007. So in 2007, about 50,000 people were contributing on a regular basis, and today it's just about 30,000. Go ahead.
How is that affecting Wikipedia's content in terms of both quality and quantity, the fact that there are fewer people contributing?
Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to know what it would have been like if more people had stuck around. I think Wikipedia has managed to continue to succeed, even though the participation has declined, and it's not dropping as fast as it used to be. But that's not really a very good trend if we look at what Wikipedia needs to do to stay up to date and expand. You know, the world is still growing, and Wikipedia should be growing to keep describing it. And if you look at the quality of Wikipedia, it still doesn't match up to the project's goals of capturing all of human knowledge. I mean, if they want to really do that, they need to be a lot more high quality and have better coverage than they have today, and that means that they need new people to join.
We'll talk about some of the challenges Wikipedia faces now, but why did this become the online encyclopedia pretty much when, you know, big names like Britannica weren't able to capture that?
I would say it came down to two things. One was cost, perhaps, and another was speed. So when Wikipedia really got started, there were many print encyclopedias still in print and probably being sold door-to-door and appearing on shelves. And there are a handful of online ones. There was Encarta, there was Britannica, but they, you know, you had to pay for those, so that's a big barrier right there. Wikipedia just outgrew those traditional encyclopedias in just a few years. I think it got started in 2001, and I think it reached 1 million articles, you know, in about 2 years from there. Today, there are 4.5 million articles, I think, in English, which is just, that just dwarfs any previous encyclopedia. I believe that the Britannica today says they have something in the realm of 70,000 articles. So Wikipedia is bigger, much, much bigger.
Now, over the years, a lot of people have made fun of Wikipedia when they've had foibles and quirks. Your piece is called The Decline of Wikipedia, but I don't get the sense that you're crowing about this. You think this is important and we should worry about the future of Wikipedia. Why should we care?
Absolutely. Well, people are going to Wikipedia because it seems like, you know, having a good, broad, free information resource is something that's very valuable to society. You know, that's not just people that are late doing their homework, but I, you know, in being able to look up information, I think is a great thing that the internet was always supposed to bring us, and Wikipedia has turned out to be the main way that happens. The director for Wikimedia Foundation, which is the nonprofit behind Wikipedia, has a nice way of talking about the internet as a whole. She kind of thinks of the internet as a city. You know, it's a city. It has a lot of billboards. It has a lot of coffee shops and stores, retail outlets, and it has a handful of public parks. And you know, those are very important in the life of a city for it to be balanced. And she describes Wikipedia as a public park. You know, we need this kind of public space where we can mingle and learn and grow together. And Wikipedia provides that.
One issue you raise with the decline in participation in Wikipedia is that the demographic that's actually contributing hasn't changed much. It's largely white, male, Western world, probably of a certain income level. Does that hurt what we see on Wikipedia?
Yeah, I would say it's certainly reflected. There's a lot of research that shows the coverage of Wikipedia very much reflects that demographic you just described. So technical subjects related to computers are extremely well represented, and those entries tend to be pretty long. Entries about, say, African cities, even large African cities, tend to be quite small and poor quality. The arts is not particularly well represented either.
So what, if anything, is the Wikipedia community, the Wikipedia Foundation doing to try to turn things around, right the ship, and get more people involved?
Yeah, well, the good news is that there are things being tried, and it looks like some of them are having some effect. Inside the community, although I found in doing my research that there are many Wikipedia contributors who don't really see this as a problem. They don't really want to welcome in more people because they see that as causing more work for them. There are many people that do care about it, and so there are some efforts in the community to help volunteers learn. There's something called the Tea House, which is a virtual place. You can go online and ask questions about how to contribute to Wikipedia. Wikimedia Foundation has hired a lot of researchers and software engineers out here in San Francisco, and they're doing all kinds of experiments to try and trace what happens when new people join and what puts them off and maybe what makes them more likely to stick around.
And something as simple as Facebook has its like button. I think you describe the thank button as one of those experiments. Can you talk about that?
I can, yes. So as I mentioned, tremendous amount of work from the community went into developing tools to kind of stamp down on bad edits and reverse vandalism. But Wikimedia Foundation realized that there weren't a lot of tools that made it easy to spread goodwill, like the like button does. So they added this thing called the thank button. Now if you or I went on there and made an edit, another editor could see that and they just have to click once and, you know, we would receive a thank you message. And that has actually proven to... I believe, you know, they have the figures that kind of show that it does make people more likely to keep going.
And one, you mentioned, you touched on this briefly. We've seen issues in recent years of finding out that people have been Wikipedia editors for hire, helping to promote a business or a band or a performer. Politicians and their campaigns getting in the game and trying to get access to be able to edit their politician's page. Has that been reined in largely, or is that still a contentious issue in Wikipedia?
I think that's still a contentious issue. There was a recent case that was uncovered, a ring of contributors that have been created by a PR company that was taking money to write and edit entries. My understanding from speaking with people in the Wikipedia editor community is that that is still very much an issue. The power that Wikipedia has, you know, the position that it has, you know, sixth most accessed website, means that, of course, people will try and manipulate it. And it will always, I think, be one of the tasks of the community to try and be vigilant to that kind of distortion. The recent case was, I think it was alarming that people were trying this, but the good news was that, you know, it did get chased down, and there are these very dedicated volunteers who are willing to, without payment, put in a lot of work to try and help the accuracy of the project.
I wonder if this decline of Wikipedia that you write about is part of a fundamental change in our concept of the internet, where a lot of people, visionaries, were looking at it as an opportunity for us to collaborate, to work together, crowdsource, if you will, projects. And now the internet is a place to tell the world about ourselves on social media and to buy stuff. Is Wikipedia using an old model that maybe doesn't apply anymore?
I think that's one way of looking at it, yes. If you're a person getting started out on the internet today, I think you'll probably find yourself pretty quickly in this world of Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr, you know, these places which are run for commercial reasons where you maintain your personal feed of updates. And the Wikipedia model is rarer than it used to be, I think. There are certainly some specialized wikis and collaborative communities out there, but there are a few really huge collaborative products like Wikipedia anymore. And I've certainly spoken with people that think that shift in what the internet is for, not seeing it as a public space so much anymore, but as a private and commercial space, that could arguably make it difficult for the project in the future.
And just briefly, the look of the site hasn't changed much since it started. Is there talk of prettying things up and making it a little more modern looking?
They have made some changes along that lines, but they haven't changed it that much. One reason for that is that the Wikipedia community is very resistant to change. And by way of example, I was told about they had this project. They wanted to make the page where you create an account look friendlier. And one part of doing that was that they switched the font on that page. They used this font called Helvetica, which looks nice and modern. You probably recognize it in a lot of corporate logos. Just changing the font led to quite a lot of online protest, the complaint of that Wikipedia was being Facebookized. And I think that just shows how difficult it is to change Wikipedia. There are so many people in the editing community that do not want it to change, that it's very difficult to just redesign it overnight.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Tom Simonite. He's computing editor for MIT Technology Review.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the challenges facing female soldiers in the United States military. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.